You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Red Center. And Jason, we're here on location.
Yeah, it's nice to get out of the FXPHD penthouse.
The tech penthouse, yes. We're on location because we want to have a look. You can't see this if you're listening at home, or in your car, but we're actually on set with one of the Red cameras shooting with anamorphic lenses here at what you like to joke as the Nakatomi building, but actually is a downtown office block. And we're here like a late at night, obviously after all of the normal workers have gone, for a film that's being shot. And the guys, luckily, in particular the DOP, has invited us on set to have a look at these anamorphic lenses. And Jason, we were just discussing before we went on air, and we're obviously trying to get Tom during the break to have a chat, but you haven't shot with these yet, but you actually said you were looking to try and get some anamorphic lenses.
Yeah, it's really hard. There seems to be some sort of drought internationally, and obviously one of the main sort of sources of anamorphic lenses is Panavisions, and they're not quite so easy to get your hands on if you want to put them on a Red. But yeah, internationally there seems to be, and I really don't know why, there seems to be quite hard to find. Most times I've tried to source them, they've had to come from New Zealand or from UK. So, yes, lucky to get your hands on them if you can.
Well, because we're recording this slightly ahead, in a second we'll cross back to ourselves, back at the loft for the news. Then later on we hope to hook up with Tom, and then even further after that, Jason, you have a really good interview coming up with someone who's actually taken a Red into the Gulf.
Yeah, a fantastic Staff Sergeant Scott Matthews, who's he's gone into Afghanistan with a Red, one-man crew, shooting gunship style out of Black Hawks and all sorts of things. There's some fantastic, he's got some fantastic stories.
So all that coming up again later in the show, but right now we'll cross back to us in the ourselves, effectively, in the studio for the latest news, and then we'll come back out on set after that.
Over to us. Okay, well, thanks us, and we're here for the news.
Actually, the really good thing about having this audience listening to Red Center is that they're intelligent enough to know what we're doing with editing. Do you know what I mean? Like, in general stuff, you wouldn't do this because it'd be too confusing, but you guys all know that we just jumped from our location to the studio through editing because you're all bright people that have...
That we haven't cloned ourselves. There's not, God forbid, there's not more of us.
So we're doing this right before we go to air, simply because we want to get the news... and also we're going to include the IBC news, which we'll come up to in a second. But let's go off with general news first, and do you want to take us away there, Jase?
Okay, well, the first thing is a little piece of software being released called ClipFinder. ClipFinder 2, apparently. I didn't know there was a ClipFinder 1. Mike, what do we know? I'll give you the blurb. ClipFinder 2 features, theoretically, it sounds like it's a R3D browsing and porting tool. Clip browsing with a list and a thumbnail view. A little loop for viewing clips at 100% magnification. You can annotate the clips, do a really quick file import into Final Cut Pro, support for Automator actions, and a really simple conform feature for Final Cut projects. So that sounds pretty wild.
Yeah, we haven't had a chance to test it here at the FXPHD Labs, but we actually have trained people on it right now. Actually, this and another thing that came out very recently, which was... monkey extract, and we're working on those as we speak, actually, testing those and putting through their paces. And monkey extract is another really interesting thing that's basically, well, you tell us about it, Jase.
Okay, monkey extract. I just scrolled past it, sorry.
Okay.
Okay, quickly render 3D footage, red footage for grading using an EDL. Basically, after feedback from the community, there's a new version of Monkey Extract out for download. If you don't know what Monkey Extract is, it's basically a tool for automating the rendering of footage for grading.
Yeah, so there's a number of tools that are helping in the process of getting stuff out, and this is another one of those. And I actually believe this one's pretty good, and initial reports from Jim, who's been working on it, is that it's great. So he's actually working on that today, and we'll be putting some stuff together. So obviously we haven't a chance to get it through in the labs, but we will, and we'll include a review of both of those in an upcoming Red Center. Now, Jase, last week, I believe, we mentioned the DLSR killer on Red News, and since we've discussed that, The kind folk at the mothership have actually given us slightly more information.
Well, it's not official name, but it now has a little slot there right next to Epic and Scarlet on Red User. It's now unofficially called the DSMC. Red are developing for late 09, a replacement for DSLRs. That's a pretty bold claim. Currently called DSMC, or Digital Still and Motion Camera.
To be the DMZ.
DMZ. It's not meant, obviously not meant to be a replacement for Epic or Scarlett. It's directly targeted at DSLRs.
Which, as we said last week, I think, is a huge ask. And I think, actually, while it is aimed at DSLRs, I've got a feeling that, in reality, it's aimed at that midpoint between sort of D90 territory, right?
Where yeah.
It's a combination of video and stills, not just a stills camera.
Exactly. Well, you've got D90 sort of doing 720p, and then theoretically there's the new Canon, which is going to do 1080p. So
that's the replacement for the 5D?
5D Mark II, possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that has not really been... It's just a little teaser shot on the Canon website as we speak. But so obviously they're going, DSLRs are slowly sort of heading more towards trying to do, now that they've got like live view, basically they've essentially got the technology to take the video they're porting to the LCD and start putting it to a card itself.
Well, I think one of the things a lot of people have commented on is that there are many aspects of a DLSR, which are, just historic, the whole reflex mirror action type stuff, and that a lot of stuff inherited because they wanted to make a digital version of an SLR look just like an SLR so it would get acceptance. And that having probably, fully happened, obviously, and it's probably less relevant now, but I can understand in the early days that you wanted to look like a SLR, you wanted to feel like an SLR, and a lot of the design sort of concepts translated over. But if Red had had a chance to pour water on this, to just calm themselves down and say, look, we kind of mentioned that prematurely, I think they did the exact opposite since we spoke last.
Let me just go through some of the comments, because some of them are crackers. Revolution applies more to this than the red one did to cinema itself.
That's a quote from Jim.
These are all from Jim. If people are not stunned by the specs and the design of the DSMC, I will retire, truly.
Okay, so you heard it first. If you aren't stunned, it's going to result in some pretty interesting things. But he even went further, didn't he?
We believe it marks the end of the DSLR. I will also say that the DSMC is the most beautiful thing we've ever done, maybe the most desirable object in the world, and it will be metal.
And what I liked was that Jared, Matt, and Dina, and John all think it's the coolest thing in the pipeline. Now, if you know any of the guys that work for Jim, they are normally one notch down in the enthusiastic voicing department. Heck of a nice bunch of guys, really nice. And so I'm not taking anything away from Jim's comment, but almost those guys thinking that it's the coolest thing.
Yeah.
Actually kind of almost carries more weight than the other comments for me. I don't know why I say that.
I'm not definitely not being a fan. Well, I'm sure I sound like one. I'm trying not to be a fanboy about this. I have sold my Nikon D200, and there's just too much going on, too many rumors, and Photokina's not here yet. And I was going to go and buy something. I was going to go and buy a D90, but I think I'm actually going to...
I'm just going to sit there
for a little bit and just see what's going on. It's just far too much... in the wind.
If you're somebody that feels that you can't wait to spend money and you do need to get out and actually, spend something on your credit card, Red has made it significantly easier and more difficult, I guess, in one sense, to actually give them to sort of bend some plastic.
With the opening of the official Red store is now open at Lake Forest, California. Cameras, accessories, and a workflow station is available for browsing. Red products and workflow. Retail sales there. There's limited run T-shirts. Jim told me there's a cap with a little compact flash card holder in it.
Have you been talking to Jim?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We talk all the time.
Oh, cool. So a cap and is that one of the exclusive things you have to go to the store to get?
Exactly.
Really?
Exactly. It's a bit of a walk from here, but
bloody hell, it's a bit of a walk from here.
So if anyone's been, send us some snaps. There's only one snap on Red Use. I'd love to see.
Well,
I haven't
been talking to Jim, but I have been talking to the other guys and. Just checking on the update on the 16 gig cards, and literally as of end of last week, they were saying that they're not shipping and that they're going to ship any second now. That was just a couple of last minute things.
Okay.
So they're ready to go, and because I was going to get one, and just, you know, offered to test it and do stuff, and they were like, "Yep, not quite there. There's just a couple more things we want to sort out." So, but they sounded imminent. Now I know they've sounded imminent before, but yeah, definitely we got the impression that they were just about ready, but not quite. So if you're waiting on those 16 gig cards, unfortunately, you have to wait a little bit longer.
I'm sure there's plenty of people waiting for them. Yeah.
Now there's a couple of other leading up to IBC. There's been a bunch of discussions of new gear and stuff released. Digital Vision announced that they'd be adding native support for Red Code RAW format. Autodesk published that they had signed on the SDK. So a number of companies, as we predicted, have released press releases saying that they're going to do stuff with the SDK. The one that caught my attention, which I thought was really interesting, and I did actually send a bunch of emails trying to get a bit of inside goss for the show, was that Assimilate and Adobe put out a joint press release. And I got to tell you, the press release was both intriguing and hysterically funny. It was hysterically funny because it basically said Adobe and Assimilate, who makes Scratch, have agreed to do stuff together. and it was like, I'm sorry, did I miss something? What are they doing? So they're going to integrate and work closely in the post-production pipeline. And I said to them, and I'm friends with the guy, so I was partly tongue-in-cheek. I was like, I'm sorry, has anything actually changed? I mean, and I basically got, shut up, Mike. We can't say anything yet because we only just started working together, but, you know, stuff is coming. So, interestingly, the press release, I think, was just, you know, it was just funny. It was worded funny. What they're trying to say is Adobe is really committed to the R3D workflow. At FX Guide TV, the guys have done an interview with the Adobe guys talking about the Adobe Red workflow, and that's all going to be coming on FX Guide TV. But from Assimilate's point of view, it's really interesting because I wouldn't necessarily put Assimilate and Adobe together, being that they're such differently sized and targeted companies.
What do you think they're going to come up with? What?
I think I have no idea. I'm not breaking any NDAs. I actually think what's going to happen is that Adobe is really committed to the R3D format because when Scarlett comes along, it makes a big difference. And let's face it, Assimilate, as we've discussed, has more knowledge about the matrixing and, you know, hardcore R3D stuff than almost anyone. So I would imagine that down the track we'll see workflows where things are better integrated and there'll be more export functions from Scratch that are in a format that either Premiere or After Effects just loves to death, and that there'll be, say, metadata grading information. This is a guess. This is not, sure, not an NDA.
Yeah.
But you'd be able to, say, grade something in Scratch and then pass over the metadata of the grade to, say, After Effects, so that having graded something in, say, Scratch and given a look, you don't have to bake that when handing it on to, say, Adobe, because that would be a shame, right? Because you've got the effects guys ready to go. And I want to take that. I don't want to take the raw R3Ds and skip the grade, nor do I want to have to bake it in and then lose the fact that Adobe can read the R3Ds. So my guess is that's the sort of thing we might see. But again, based not on any fact, just a, you know, educated guess for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Now, there's another big thing that's happening back on the... Oh, and by the way, we'll be continuing to review Red products that actually are implementing the Red workflow, as we discussed earlier. But we have got a couple of really cracker things, as we mentioned, when we're on set coming up to talk about, to do with lenses and stuff. So we're not doing any more of that this week. But there is one big thing before we get back to Tom on set to discuss the anamorphic lenses, which is the audio upgrades on the Red cameras.
Yeah, so your camera has been, you've had the retrofit done.
We probably shouldn't say that. Well, yeah, okay.
Okay.
I have had it done, yes.
All right.
Just done.
Okay.
Forgive me for saying that out loud.
Absolutely. Well, theoretically, by the time this goes to where everyone who, all Red One owners would have theoretically had your emails saying when you can come in and get yours fitted. Basically, all Red One's shipping from now on, from the date of broadcast, will be shipping with the upgraded audio boards and the eye pins all installed and all fully functional. Sneaked the support into...
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah, all the support for the eye pins and for the new audio boards was all snuck into Build 16 anyway. So really all you need is the hardware.
And I believe that Les from Cook Lenses, who obviously was instrumental in the... Cook was instrumental in the iTech in the first place, actually took a pinned Red to IBC. So we certainly have the pinned red, and we'll be doing testing with that. And I've been speaking to other companies like Pixel Farm about them getting access to the iTech data so they can start building out the post workflow. So that's a very much breaking, evolving thing. But I'm very enthusiastic that we're back in the game with the iTech and the iPins.
Yeah, so obviously now your camera's back. We'll obviously try to get some time with it with some
totally.
Eye encoded lenses.
Now, a couple of people have said, well, surely you just extract the eye data, the metadata, from the stream the same way you do anything else. But you have to understand that it is actually slightly different because the metadata normally is virtually shot-based. And the whole point of the iTech metadata is that it's a hundredth of a second time-based. So unlike metadata, I think the only other metadata that is time-based is actually the time code. So what we've got in the camera now is not only the time code and the two versions of that, but also a 100th of a second actual lens set of metadata. And so it isn't quite as simple as just saying, you know, go into the metadata field and hit extract metadata. So that will take a little time for people to sort out and use, but I think it'll make a really big difference to post-production.
Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that from you, Mike.
Now, is that it for this? Pretty jam-packed with the news this week, haven't we?
Well, we have, we were talking of IBC, we've got, we have a man on the ground.
Good point, I nearly forgot. So, actually, we thank Jeff Huser for this and John, who are actually at IBC.
Men on the ground.
And at the FX PhD meetup in Amsterdam, they actually got us firsthand an account of what was shown at IBC, because we discussed it, if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, Jace, we said, you know, what would be announced. We've discussed what the third parties have announced. We wanted to know what Red themselves did. So rather than me relay that, let's play that clip now.
Yes, hello, my name is Arnaud Paris. I was at the Red meeting speaking for Locared and Seismic Films, two companies involved into the Red in the French market. The three main points of the meeting were first that the Red is really taking off for features. We had Brian Maffitt who was talking about the experience of Soderbergh on the Che. There are many features that are slated on the Red for 2008, 2009, and these features are going to be done by major studios. Ted Chelovitz was explaining how the Red camera is still in development with more features coming soon, but the fact that the post-production has to adapt to the workflow, basically. We also had the good opportunity to watch some 35mm transfers from the Red footage. And to my opinion, this was really good because the Red camera has a very... I would say not video but pristine look that lacks a bit of organic sometimes, and the 35mm footage was just mind-blowing, done from the Cinevator process, and that was probably the most interesting thing that we saw yesterday, was to look at the footage transferred to 35mm. And well, the third point that was addressed yesterday was about how the Red camera was going to evolve as far as the future. And not so much was said by Ted Chelovitz about the sensors, but all we know is that there's going to be upgradability for the Red camera. It's going to be either a new sensor into the Red camera or a new camera with the EPIC. That's what was said yesterday, and hopefully we'll know more in the next few weeks.
Okay, so sounds like nothing new really announced, other than instead of at NAB where we're looking at 4K projected as 4K, the IBC community were looking at Red projected as film.
Right, yeah, which is obviously adding a lot of the sort of film quality, which people think is missing from the digital side of things, which is in a way it is.
Yeah, and apparently Ted had great fun. He was in good spirits. He actually stole Jeff Hughes's camera at one stage and ran around taking photos. So later in the evening, Jeff tracked him down, got his camera back, and discovered all these weird photos that Ted had been taking with him.
Nice.
Yeah, so that was great. And as I said earlier, there's a great interview coming up on FX Guide TV with Adobe where they discuss in depth the Red workflow, and that was recorded by John and Jeff in Amsterdam.
Now, of course, we're recording this on 16th of September. The show's still going?
It is the last day of the show, if you allow for the time zone.
Yeah, okay. So there still may be some... I'm sure there'll be more information filtering through as we go.
Yeah, I mean, I think IBC is no longer a news-breaking show quite the way that NAB is.
It doesn't sound like it, does it?
Yeah, but, you know, it's obviously a good show. I know that Ted had some, you know, big slide stuff showing sensors, because, you know, we were discussing that thing that Stu did with the sensor things.
Yeah.
He had his own version of that at IBC, and we'll try and get some photos and stuff as the guys finish up their partying. Apparently, the Simulate party was really good this year, and one of the best parties going, so...
Where is it again? It's in,
Amsterdam.
Amsterdam. Well, I'm sure.
I know what you're thinking. But so, look, we need to get continue going because you have, as I said, we're going to talk to Tom about the anamorphic lenses and this absolutely amazing interview that you did coming up later in the show, Jace, with what has got to be one of the most interesting Red stories with Staff Sergeant Scott Matthews of the Air Force.
Yeah, no, that's definitely going to be one to not just get show notes, but there's going to be really, it should be one of those ones where you should have a look at the footage while you're listening to it or afterwards, but because the footage he's got is half the story there.
Now, having said that, that shot in the show notes you've got with him cradling a Red with a huge lens on it, with his own, of course, rifle, which, you know, sensibly needs, but behind him there's this... automatic machine gun hanging out the side of an attack helicopter. You know, it's just, I have nothing but respect for what those guys do. And of course, it's very hardcore managing that camera. And I think some of the ways he came up with dealing with it and the weight of it on a Black Hawk was phenomenally interesting. But that's coming up later in the show.
Yep.
Let's now cross back to,
us
on set where we recorded this the other night because it was a night shoot. And we'll pick that up from on set.
Well, that's a really seamless cross back to ourselves, isn't it? So, as I said before we went to the news, we're actually on set here at a night location with the Red hooked up with an anamorphic lens. And, Jace, let's just discuss this for people that don't necessarily... I mean, obviously, most people know what anamorphic is, but let's discuss the principles of what's going on here, because it actually impacts based on the size of the sensor, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, theoretically, the sort of the setup for a motion picture camera, you'd have a full-frame 35mm... piece of film, of course, and have an anamorphic lens, which essentially at either the front or the back has an anamorphic element, which essentially is almost like a wide-angle adapter, but only in one direction, I suppose you can call it. So essentially the way of thinking about it in terms of field of view, and this will come into play when we talk to Tom later on, is that essentially it gives you a wider field of view horizontally than you would normally associate. If you put a 50mm lens on, essentially it'll give you 50mm field of view top to bottom, but it'll actually look like a 25mm lens
horizontally.
So when
you associate this with like Lawrence of Arabia and a lot of the, you know, really big budget films, when, and there are a lot of things we like about this lens, not least of which is the lens flares.
Oh.
But it is predicated, and this is sort of just a bit of a primer before we talk to Tom, it's predicated on the assumption that the film in the gate is, as you say, 4 perf and it's full height. Whereas normally we're kind of thinking what we're going to do is cut out from that 35 4 perf. I mean, I think it was last week we discussed 3 perf. And 3 perf relies on the fact you don't normally use the top and the bottom of the frame. Bit of wasted neg there, so we're not going to use it. But anamorphic doesn't do that. Instead of cutting out a standard kind of cut that albeit wide from the piece of 35 film, this obviously can use full height because it gets its width now not from the film width, but from the fact that it's squashed horizontally.
Exactly. So, yeah, you're using all the negative and essentially creating the widescreen later on in post-production when you essentially double the width, if that makes sense.
Right. And, of course, the only way to get that without an anamorphic lens is to halve the height on normal 35 film, hence the wasted film I mentioned a second ago. So now, how does that play, though, in a Red? Because the Red sensor, we talk about Red having a full 35mm sensor, but it doesn't actually have a full 35mm sensor in the sense of full gate 4 perf 35, does it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of being direct, I'm a little slightly rusty in the exact names of all the formats, but I guess they call it Super 35, is that
right.
What they call it? Yeah. So essentially, it's slightly wider than it is than the a full 35mm piece of film, but not as high. So it's essentially, I think the sensor's 16 by 9.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, of course, we sometimes do a 2x1 from that, or we do a 16x9 from
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
In both cases, the lens is completely independent of its orientation. In other words, this lens actually cares where horizontal is. Obviously, a normal lens doesn't care whatsoever. It's equal in every direction.
Exactly. There's a piece of kit called a mesmerizer lens, which is essentially the front element of an anamorphic lens, which you bolt on the front of a normal lens, and you can actually do this incredibly wild. I'm trying to think of the film. Maybe it's...
Lost in Las Vegas? Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas?
I haven't seen that one, but okay. This might even be in Terror at 20,000 Feet or whatever it is, the sequence in Twilight Zone. I'm speaking out of my ass, man. I'll have to think about it. But it's this wild distortion that basically caused by taking an anamorphic element but rotating it around, spinning it around, and it sort of stretches you top to bottom, then it stretches you side to side, and it's quite wild. So, yes, the lens is essentially...
Often used in cheaper films, sort of like drug-induced haze yes. of actor as falls to the ground while drugged by
exactly.
by evil guy.
Exactly. So, yes, the lenses have an orientation, essentially. They have to sort of... the anamorphic element has to sort of point to top to bottom.
All right, well, let's go and see if we can find Tom and have a chat how he's finding this. But I guess the number one thing is, you said yourself you would like to shoot with anamorphic. You said you tried getting some. So
definitely.
I guess the question I'm going to ask you, as I will ask Tom in a minute, is... You know, why? What is it about these anamorphics that you like? Because it's not just a 2x3, because I can get that already, right?
Yeah.
So it must be something else.
It's not just the ratio. It's a couple of things. First of all, it's depth of field. Probably people are sick of me banging on about depth of field and getting... I'm always sort of on the back of the DOP trying to get as wide open as we can. And
to get a shallower depth
of field. To get a shallower depth of field, get the background out of focus as much as possible. And so why anamorphic? You'll know... When you see the difference between an anamorphic film and a film shot spherically, it's not subtle. It's quite incredible the difference in the depth of field, because essentially, on a spherical film, to get a shot where you essentially want a 25 mil kind of wide angle shot, you use a 25 mil. On an anamorphic film, you use a 50 millimeter lens. So essentially, you're getting almost twice that depth of field, or half the depth of field, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So essentially, the background's almost twice as out of focus for the same size shot, if that makes
right.
sense.
Right, so you've basically got a shallow depth of field.
Shallow depth of field for the same shot.
For the same shot.
And also, obviously, as we well know, Mike, the quality of that out of focus stuff is wonderful. That's wonderful sort of spherical highlights and hotspots and flares from lenses. It's just... It's what my memories of films are all about. That sort of fantastic out of focus stuff. And you see when people rack focus, if they pull focus from foreground to background, you'll see all the out of focus stuff all stretch and do this wonderful sort of. It's a very unusual sort of look that bokeh is. What you know the way the out of focus stuff looks is just. Stunning. So, I just love it.
You've got a cinematography boner talking about this,
haven't you? It's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. I just grew up looking at fabulous things like Razorback and Christine and, you know, fantastic films where they make the flares are almost a character in the film.
Well, I mean, talking about that, actually, you know, you mentioned the Nakatomi Building, but I don't know, but I remember that kind of lens flurry thing from the sort of Die Hard
yeah,
era.
Yeah, there's some fantastic pull focuses on there from from Bruce to what's his name? I can never remember his name.
Oh, the bad guy in
the bad guy.
Yes, I know.
Eric,
he was in Love Actually, I think.
Harry Potter.
There you go.
Yeah, what's that guy? What's his name?
So that's right. We mentioned about cameras, not necessarily about actors. No, I'm just joking.
Sure.
So, okay, let's go and see if we can find Tom and have a chat to him as to why he decided that for this particular production, he wanted the filmic look that he was going to get from shooting on an anamorphic lens on a red camera. Okay, and I'm just walking to Tom, who's standing next to the red camera. And, Tom, you're shooting with anamorphic lenses, and Jason and I were really interested in this, weren't we?
Been a long felt want of mine to shoot with anamorphics. I've tried and tried and tried. How'd you pull it off?
Well, dare I say, I have in the same situation. It's not easy, but I had a short film come up, and the short film allows you in some ways to experiment in ways you couldn't do on a commercial production. And I spoke to people about running anamorphics on red cameras and got pretty much a blank here in Australia, although I did check. There were some people overseas who had done it. I couldn't actually get in personal contact with. But the logic of it, there should be no problems. The dilemma here, based here in Sydney, Australia, was there was no PL anamorphic lenses available. They're all PV mount, designed by Panavision. But Camera Equip in Melbourne run a set of PLs, so we got them up.
So what lenses are you shooting with? You've got a really interesting sort of bunch of lenses here.
Yeah, they were Russian Lomos, which make a lovely budget anamorphic lens. But, you know, it's not a perfect piece of glass. But look, I'm a bit of a believer that glass should have character, and there's an awful lot of tremendously sharp, wonderful lenses out there that, frankly, are a little boring.
That's the thing about the new anamorphics, I guess, and Panavision and all that sort of stuff. They have sort of perfected them and made them so wonderfully clean and crisp. They've kind of taken all the character out.
Yes.
And got rid of most of the lens flare. And we love anamorphic lens flares.
Absolutely, absolutely. And look, it probably is a good thing that many of those aberrations are painful, but you would never discount using a lens because it's not the latest.
Of course.
I think a lot of glass that were making films like The Godfather in the 80s, they look fantastic, and people might sort of sneer at them now, but by God, they are capable of producing really wonderful results. And people.
Now, let me just ask you about this, because there's an anamorphic button on the back, or menu option on the back of the Red camera itself, but it's not quite that simple, is it?
Yes, absolutely. Anamorphic on Red is a square hole and a round peg. There is an anamorphic mode. Really, if I understand it correctly, it's simply 4K 16:9, and the camera produces frame lines that allow you to frame where you'll take your anamorphic center cut. So, yes, there's an ana mode, they call it, but it's just some simple guidelines.
So you're actually viewing things squeezed then?
Squeezed, and dare I say that is a nightmare.
Yeah.
Without getting overly technical, you've got
actually, we like technical.
Okay, you asked
please,
for it.
Please go technical. We've occasionally been known to.
Yeah, you've also got anamorphic lenses. They're squeezing things 2:1. That means when you're looking in your viewfinder, you're seeing everything squeezed 2:1. So everyone's extremely tall and thin, and the picture is squashed. To imagine the composition is actually way more difficult than you would hope. You can't. It's very hard. You look at that squeezed picture, and you can't really frame. So that's a real problem. On film cameras, they have viewfinders which have an unsqueezed lens, and you can get the correct picture.
Exactly.
Whether a Red camera, I doubt if the Red one will ever be capable of that. And even the monitors that exist for film cameras are designed on the assumption that they're being fed a 4:3 TV signal that is 2:1 squeezed. So even if you've got a Panavision anamorphic monitor, it's going to be fed a 16:9. 2:1 image.
Yes, we noticed the excellent, the very elegant director's viewfinder setup.
Because just for people that don't know what we're saying, on set, literally, the director is here tonight viewing the split, holding up a piece of glass that is stretching it like a viewfinder.
Exactly. It is a anamorphic projection lens stolen off an old projector, and it's designed to de-squeeze 2:1. So we just paper over the sides of the 16:9 image that will never be used, and then view via this projector lens, and you get a reasonably accurate idea of the picture.
So really, that is ideally what Red's anamorphic mode should do for us.
That would be a wonderful thing.
I presume.
Yes.
That'll be an epic thing, I'm sure.
I would, and hint, if yes. I could, the real, I mean, that's a pain in the ass, the monitoring. The real dilemma for anamorphic and Red is it's a 3-perf size or 16:9 sensor. The whole point of anamorphic lenses was designed for a squarish gate on a film camera. So it's a very inefficient use of the sensor.
Okay, so I'm just going to step in now because we need to draw word pictures. So what we're saying is, and I'll go through it slowly, though obviously some of you will get this instantly. On a normal piece of 35mm that's coming down vertically through the gate, we don't use all of it because to get a wide picture, we just throw away a lot of top and bottom, a lot of wasted negative that's just not used. Now, when they do anamorphic, because we're no longer worried about trying to stay 1:1 on the pixels effectively, they're obviously not pixels in film, but you know what I'm saying. So now what we say is, oh, well, we can use all of that height because even though we're using all the height, we don't have enough width, but that doesn't matter because we're squeezing it. We don't need to have the film wider than it actually is.
which is great, except for the fact that Red built their sensor based on the fact that we're just going to use a Super 35 cut. And of course, they didn't build sensor for stuff that in film is wasted. I mean, why would you build sensor for stuff that, you know, is wasted? It makes no sense unless you hit anamorphic. And it's the first time when you hit anamorphic that you start to use that wasted neg. Hence, we've no longer got any sensor left. And so we now actually have to crop in, don't we, effectively getting less of the sensor area to get the anamorphic effect.
What that means is you are effectively losing at least 25% of your picture. So you're partly losing the effectiveness of those anamorphics because each lens is actually a longer lens. So it's if you actually took your 4K image, by the time you're finished with it, assuming you're finishing in 2.35, I think it's about 2.3K across. So there's an awful lot of sensor that just isn't getting used. And your lenses, for any given focal length, are much longer. And I should say, I should backtrack a little bit, the whole why we would bother with anamorphic. I mean, in the early days, it was about film grain and using film negative more efficiently. It was a format designed to be square. Then widescreen came out and anamorphic was a way of doing that. But really, the reason I think probably what others would think is there is a look, and that's what it's all about, anamorphic lenses. There's a very shallow depth of field. There's a kind of weird optical distortion, especially in the out of focus, in the bokeh. And this is something, and probably, look, I'm guessing, but would you guys agree that around half the big, big budget American Hollywood films would be anamorphic?
It's getting less and less.
Less and less, true, yeah, true. Definitely. It has fallen off, but we would have grown up watching the biggest budget movies, probably many of them done anamorphic.
Even today, they are having to fight tooth and nail to shoot anamorphic. They're having to fight a good friend of mine, Pete Menzies Jr., who shot The Hulk. What's the name of the new... Release, the re-released Hulk, reimagined.
You mean the new Hulk?
Yes.
Yes.
They had to really push, and go into absolute battle to shoot that in scope.
Okay.
Which is really surprising when you imagine what the budget would be. So it's probably less than that. It might be a third.
There's not so much the technical requirement for scope because film stocks are kind of extremely good. You can shoot 2.35 and you can just cut it. I think, and you might correct me, Mike, the VFX guys aren't too keen on anamorphic lenses because of the distortions in them.
Well, there's some issues harder to do with 3D tracking, and there's a few other things. And let's face it, you know, the distortion does add to that. Obviously, there's a look that is, you know, a non-standard look in a certain sense that you're trying to replicate. And so there's a lot of things that, in terms of like how things curve and bend when you're trying to put CG into the shot, that you're going to have to match to make it work.
Yeah, so it's a sort of non-linear focus at effect, which would be, you know, I'm not quite sure how the 3D guys deal with it.
So I'll just step back and talk through the physical process of what you're doing. So you're shooting 16:9 4K.
Yes.
And you're obviously shooting a squeezed image.
Yes.
So then obviously we then have to get to make everyone not look 6 foot high.
Absolutely.
12 foot high.
You
we
end
have
up
to stretch that twice as wide. So we end up with almost 2 16:9 in a way.
Exactly. 2 16:9 images next which to I'm each other not in a calculate. Way. It's a new format, 3:1 or something like that.
Which is obviously a lot wider than the 2.35 or 2.4
yes,
or
so
whatever.
So it's useless.
You extract.
Yeah, right. You can't use it.
So everybody, if you're imagining we've created a much wider image than a much more widescreen image than actual CinemaScope. So so then what you're talking about in losing quality, you actually have to crop some of the sides off that to create 2.35:1.
Nearly, my God, if my calculations and my mathematics, I did fail maths at school, I will confess now, but I think it's nearly half.
Okay, but as we said, the reason that you're doing this in the first place is to get just like a really cool look.
Absolutely.
And so let's ask how you think it looks. I mean, because we're talking about how it works technically. How did you actually like the look of stuff you're filming tonight?
I just loved it. I mean, I think it looks absolutely superb. We're doing a film about a cleaner who's working in an office, an incredibly plain, dreary. We looked for the most dreary office we could find. And it's a story of isolation. So the focus really allows us to isolate our characters. It takes a somewhat, again, a dreary environment and applies a little bit of magic to it. The And I suppose in some ways too, it's just something that separates it from the rest. A lot of films get made. I think you probably see anamorphic in commercials a fair bit too. Probably always on film if you've got the budget because of the depth of field more than anything else.
Yeah. No, look, as soon as I can find some glass in the actual country where I don't have to... The last time I investigated it, it was kind of like, well, you can freight these lenses in or you can have some lights.
Well, if I could give a pitch to Camera Quip, and unfortunately I get no kickback, they've got Lomos now and they also have the new Hawk anamorphics.
Excellent.
And these are top-of-the-line anamorphics. They're PL mount. But until Red decide to come out with a 4.3 sensor, which, dare I say, Arriflex have with their D21, and that's really separated them from the pack.
And so I presume Genesis is...
No.
No.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
No.
Right, okay.
Exactly, you would imagine. But I think, really, totally honest, people just didn't really think it through. And as you've said, anamorphic has been on decline. Mm. But if you were thinking of doing a project... Look, and I should say one other thing too. It's a cool look. It looks fantastic, but you would, and I think one of the studio issues is it's hard to shoot. I mean, 35mm can be shallow depth of field, and it can be time-consuming. You need focus pullers. You need to put marks down. But suddenly in anamorphic, you have half that again. So suddenly you've got an actor in a wide shot, and it's 3 inches of focus.
Yeah.
So
that's why it looks. It's that's worth, why it looks it's cool. It's a look worth battling for.
But absolutely. But then that's the pain of time, because suddenly your focus puller really needs work and time.
Yeah. This is not a format for the brave-hearted, for the
faint-hearted for sure, and it's certainly not for a documentary shoot. It's sort of, you know, there is some pain for the gain for sure. Look, at OnePlus anamorphic lenses are notoriously soft, but one of the strange advantages of the Red camera with cutting off the edges is you're using the sweet spot of the lens anyway. So I was quite comfortable running those lenses wide open, which we did for the entire shoot. Now, if we were doing the whole lens, I would have thought, ooh, dangerous.
Yeah, so what are they actually rated at? I mean, what's the sort of...
The Lomos, they vary, unfortunately, but I think the fastest one's 2.2. and the slowest 3.1. So that's not shabby.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. So despite all the sort of workarounds, so far what you've seen, the look has still been worthwhile.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was a bit afraid that all those negatives would degenerate that look, so it wasn't really worth it. And this was an experiment, I would consider it a win. Having said that, we're finishing in a letterbox 16.9235. If you then zoomed again into the picture to give a full frame 16x9, I'll have to do some tests there. You're losing even more again. But I still think you'd end up with a pretty special look.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about looking filmic. And it, as we said, you know, it can get overly technically obsessed with pixel count. And
absolutely.
At the end of the day. Yeah. But I just have one quick. Did you actually, have you managed tonight or at any point to shoot some nice flares? Because I just...
No, we're in an office block lit with fluoros. No, so I couldn't find... and we had a torch, especially. Little girl had a torch, and we were hoping to get that into the lens, but, you know, the nature of blocking, and it's a small girl, she never actually got the torch in the lens.
Mike's on a desperate quest to shoot some anamorphic flares.
Can I ask a favour? Can you add the anamorphic flares later in post?
Well, yeah, if you shoot some, we'll absolutely add some.
Well, actually, we could do. I've sent the lenses back, but, yeah, it's something to look into.
If you shoot some, we'll comp some for you for free.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and letting us come on set. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And if I could leave a last message, epic 4x3. Then the camera can play with the big boys.
It's been logged. And
it's been logged. It's been linear. No, sorry. That's a bad censor joke. Yeah, no, we really do appreciate it. It's been great. So thanks so much, man.
All right, thank you. Yeah, thanks.
That was great. He was fantastic source of info. Really, really great. I'm glad.
Yeah, I've known Tom for a while. He's a really good guy, actually, and a good DOP.
No, I'm glad. That's a lot of info now. I'm fully sorted. I'll go and do my own one now.
Get you. Hey, so look, talking about really good interviews, you've got a cracker coming up with someone that actually took a Red into the Gulf. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've got fantastic through a contact through FXPHD. We've got a fantastic interview with Staff Sergeant Scott Matthews, who took a Red into Afghanistan and took it right into the flight line and shot out of the side of Black Hawks.
And I've got nothing but respect for those guys. Imagine actually
I mean, for a start, right? Like, it's a war. I mean, full stop, it's a war. But then secondly, like, the Red isn't the most portable camera. So,
yeah, and he chose a really unportable lens. There's, there's a couple of shots we'll put in the show notes.
But it was great that you managed to track him down and you know, get his experience, what it was like, take it in. And as I think you asked him about, he's looking to do more of this, isn't he? So.
Yeah, he wants to go back and really cover it for the sake of, you know, for its historical value, not just to show, you know.
That's true, isn't it? The historical value is just something, I mean, really, in the moment you kind of forget about, but this is going to be something that people will look back on for years to come.
Yeah.
Well, let's cross to Jason and that interview now, and we'll cross back to the studio after that.
Okay, I've got the great honour today of speaking to Staff Sergeant Scott Matthews from the United States Air Force, who also runs his own production company, Glory Cubed. Hey, Scott.
Howdy.
Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, not a problem. Glad I can offer some insight.
I'm sure you will. Now, look, I think of all the people we've spoken to on the podcast, your images have to be some of the most outstanding we've seen, not just because of the amazing situations, but you really do seem to have a really filmic eye. It's really interesting to see those kind of images come out of what essentially is a war zone.
Right, right. There's a good deal of background behind that story in itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, you enlisted in the National Guard in 2001 with the goal of being a Black Hawk pilot.
Right.
1 month later, with the 9/11 attacks, that all changed.
They were like, well, you know, it's going to be a while for you to get that slot because now all our pilots aren't going anywhere. We don't need to move anybody in or out. So, oh, by the way, you know, you're going to have to deploy as a mechanic. So that was a kind of a shock to the system. I didn't actually ever want to be a mechanic. I just thought it'd be a good idea. So off I went to Afghanistan as a mechanic.
Right. And you took a camera with you?
Yes. I had been going to Cogswell Polytechnic up in Sunnyvale, California. They had a new digital motion picture program that I was going with a buddy of mine, and I had come across a Canon XL1 through another friend who happened to own a pawn shop, and somebody had pawned one off at a really great price, and he's like, hey, I don't know anything about cameras, but if you're interested, you can come and I'll give you a great deal on this thing. I was like, holy cow, I was going to save up for a year just to buy a GL1, and XL1 landed in my hands, you know, poof, just like that. And I'm like, ooh, awesome. You know, too many awesome moments back to back, and so I packed it all up and brought it over and just started filming everything that I could. And shortly thereafter, I made some web videos for the families back at home, and one of them made it. Somebody sent it to the Guard Bureau out in D.C. They liked it enough to contact the unit and ask if I could film as a majority of my time there. And my staff was like, yeah, sure thing. And that's pretty much what I did for about 10 months. Off and on, I'd touch a helicopter, and the rest of the time I was filming.
Obviously, the XL1 is a bit of a leap to taking a Red 1 out into the field. Now, you got your hands on that camera pretty uniquely.
Yeah, yeah. Jared Land, after he had bought his own or his spot in line, ended up, you know, going to work with Jim over at Red in the early stages and put up his slot in a contest. And my buddy Brian Reisdorf, who was the cadet friend of mine that was working with me on the National Guard projects, he's ended up submitting the idea that won, which was a Z-Depth channel recording idea. And he called me up actually while I was out at a training. I moved over from Army to Air Force, and I was in training in Washington State, and he calls up and leaves a message on my phone out there, and he's like, holy crap, we just won that spot in line. And I'm like, well, this is, you know, this is providence after the other. You know, how many times can something just land in our laps like this? So it must be a... must be what we're supposed to be doing. So finished up the training, came home, and we started focusing on the Red, you know, 100% of the time, trying to figure out how we're going to bridge that transition. And, you know, Red user and DVX user were invaluable for that.
Now, there's an amazing shot of you standing next to a Black Hawk holding a Red with a, you know, what is a classic lens, but a huge lens, the old Ingenieur 6-1. Yeah. It's a massive handheld rig you got there.
Yes, it is.
So that's quite a rig to go into combat with.
Yes. As the popularity of the Red spread, when they found the local folks around here found out that we happened to have the first one in Tennessee, because, you know, 97, one out of 100 there is pretty special. Yeah. And we made a lot of friends really fast, and one of those friends was at a company called DRNA in Nashville, Brett Weeks, who's also on Red User. And he let us have run-of-the-mill with his lenses, and we were playing around with that for a few weeks. All the lenses that he had, his iSet, the Angenoux, and a couple other weird lenses. And we were playing with those for a while. And, the Angenoux ended up, you know, when I was over there testing out the area, and I'm like, is this going to work? Am I going to have enough time? It's probably the most expendable lens in the inventory to ship out, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, you can make do, and that was a beast. It was about, I think they measured it, weighted about 38 pounds when the brace was hooked up, the rods, the lens itself, the batteries, the LCD. So it wasn't very easy as far as handheld. I tried a couple shots, and it just wasn't really working. Plus, the tripod was just a holdover from our HVX days. So I could set it on there, but I was using my whole body to brace it and kind of balance it and kind of swivel it best I could, panning shots. You can see on the F-15, I was catching up to it every few seconds as it flew by.
Oh, you did pretty well with that one. That was really good.
Yeah, some of them turned out, and a lot of it didn't make it into that little edit.
As I say, it's very filmic stuff. It's quite amazing when you see the difference between, you know, I guess a lot of the guys out there are shooting, probably some shooting HD, but a lot of them are probably just more shooting for the web, happy snaps to send back home, and you look like you're really shooting for longevity and for historical reasons.
Exactly, that. It's kind of the combat camera and the public affairs, they have a very specific purpose, and that's to submit footage that will assist in a specific operation or telling of a story like building a school or this battle that's going on. And it's kind of, you know, get what you can get. And what I was trying to do was show that it would be possible with the Red to shoot when you're not running and dodging bullets. You can still capture history in a way that is aesthetic. They can be used for many reasons. It's not just here's the environment. It's not like a snapshot that you're looking at with motion, but here's the environment in a way that grabs your attention with that specific purpose in mind, not just relaying here's the environment alone. I kind of was using the idea, I don't remember which cinematographer said it, but you know, let the images tell the story even if there's no audio or music going with it. You know,
yeah.
Shoot that mindset as well. Why, if you can't justify it, why not just take a still? And so I was trying to capture with the camera, you know, images that a still wouldn't have been, you know, enough. And you can pull a still out later with the camera as well, which is amazing, which I've done recently. And are in those articles, actually. They pulled out a couple stills and printed them, and they look great. But it's that mindset of, you know, I could just be taking a still, and it'd probably get more use because then you can put it up on the web, you can send it out in catalogs or whatever. But I like the idea that we can shoot aesthetically now for our own history, for the world's history, actually, on this system. And I think the military and the governments should be interested in that.
Now, you have, obviously, you have to deal with the Department of Defense here and the COMCAM, the Combat Camera Program, which I guess restricts or is in control of what professionals are out there allowed to be in the field and what gear they take.
Correct.
Okay.
They assign their equipment is based on maneuverability, you know, and getting what they need back. And it was said pretty simply in the government video article that recently came out. And they're like, you know, without understanding the system and just kind of it being thrown at them, they're saying, you know, that's cool, but we have this purpose and this is the equipment we need to accomplish that goal. And it's very understandable. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying now we can go past that and put, you know, at least a special team together, train on this system, you know, until Scarlet comes out. Scarlet's going to change everything. But for now, you can, and I would still recommend doing it, you know, forever, shooting on at least a Red over there when the situation permits for the specific purpose of, you know, history's legacy, the modern generation. There's going to be tons of footage guys are going to have on little handy cams and, you know, I'm sure a lot of that's going to end up on the military channels and whatnot over the years. But why not, with this technology available at such an insane price point, do it while we can?
Well, what is their objections, really? I mean, I've read a little bit from ComCam sort of comments about the fact that obviously it's
right.
You know, it's expensive and it's bulky. But hey, that's probably no one's problem but yours.
Exactly. And and that was kind of the reason I did it as fast as I could. You know, I just wanted to prove, hey, this can easily be done. Look at these images. This is focusing on a 35 millimeter lens. It doesn't look that bad. I'm pretty proud of the shots I was able to get on the fly. Why not? And it's kind of how the military goes. It's a new idea. It was, you know, they weren't expecting it. So it's kind of just like either you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. They could be taking it seriously or they're not. Based on the dialogue I've had recently, I tried the proper channels and they were just, you know, right now we're not situated to handle HD, let alone film footage. We haven't been given any request from those above us for it. It's a great idea. I can't, you know, tell you anything more than that. And so I was like, oh, you know, at least I tried. And then randomly, just recently through the clip that I put up on the Vimeo page, I started getting some private messages from one government consulting firm and a couple Army officers who were like, you know, wow, this is something we've been talking about over here. We're glad to have seen that you've done it. We're going to try to, you know, work it through our channels. Can we bounce a lot of ideas and information off of you? And I'm like, oh, please do. You know, this is the whole point of this. It's not me trying to have this great, you know, glorious escapade. This needs to be done. Yeah. If it's not being done by me, somebody should be doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with, and how I've sort of likened this to is, you know, the color of war. And you look at so much of how we perceive, you know, First and Second World War is through black and white. And right. When you see a right. series like Color of War, where it is like they've gone and found better quality right. quality footage, and it's a real eye-opening difference in the way you perceive it. It makes you realize this what you're doing is worth fighting for.
It just seems like it's worth it for not only the public back at home, but for the people that are over there from, you know, any nation that are over there doing their part to at least have somebody documenting it in a fashion that's worth what they're doing. The Marines did it early on. They sent over a team that went over and filmed on F-900s, which was kind of the prologue to how I got to do it with the Guard. They hired the same folks to do the training, and they were in the initial invasion into Iraq, and they were using those giant cameras, and they proved it could be done there too. You know, and there's nothing wrong with a small team doing it. It doesn't have to be everybody, as long as you got a few guys doing it for history's sake.
Well, in your case, it's just been you, yeah?
Yeah, we have, in order to get, it's kind of a long airfield, and sometimes in emergencies you hop on these little, they're like little golf carts, but they're not, and you can zip around, and one day I had one of those, and that's when I went down to the Army end, because I was in the Air Force side this time, and I went to the Army end of the flight line and got the slow motion Black Hawk taxiing shot, the guys unloading and offloading, and a couple other shots down there, and then drove the camera back. Everything else was kind of just moving around a 200-foot area by my aircraft's location.
Well, you achieved a huge amount in a week. I can't imagine what you would have achieved if you'd had twice that time.
Yeah, that is the biggest thing I'm trying to get across, is if we can do that with this camera in just 1 week's time, using about 45 minutes of light, you know, imagine what we could do with full rain of any camp, any base, any location with, you know, a month here or there, it'd be amazing.
You also did some stuff in the cockpit. It looks like you've also got to go up in Black Hawk.
Oh, yes, yes. That was a goal the entire time, and it kind of came about when you watch those Vietnam documentaries, and there's a couple of shots that they use in a lot of films that look like they're just shot directly out the back of a plane or a helicopter, and you see all those napalm rounds going off in slow motion, and it's this perfectly fluid shot flying over the jungles of Vietnam, and it was like the clearest shot I've ever seen, and I've seen it in a couple movies, and I wanted to kind of grab that kind of shot. You know, there aren't explosions going off, but the opportunity to fly, which I was part of, was I was like, I'm not going to pass this up, and I just had to find a way to stabilize the camera somewhat because it was too heavy to ride on my shoulder the whole time. So there is a fast rope bar across the top of the Black Hawk series of helicopters that extends out for guys to go rappelling out of. And I hung three bungee cords through the rods on the top portion of the red and kind of just suspended it there and sat underneath it. And so I could essentially shoulder it and yet have some support because it hung about, it was using the tension of those bungee cords. And so that's what I was using as they flew along on a orientation flight for the crew that was coming in. We flew around some safe areas and villages and whatnot, and I just filmed as much as I could And as I mentioned in one of the articles, that was one of the only times that I was like, I got into a moment that was a negative moment, was I went to set up the rear. It was in a 2K mode, and I was going to go back to 4K to get an air-to-air shot. And when I reached for the camera, I hit the power off button, and it just immediately turned off. And, you know, the boot up time was about a minute and a half, and there was no way for me to get that shot back. And that was the one suggestion I had out of the whole experience, was I'd love to see, kind of like when you shut down Windows, are you sure?
Yeah.
And you know, kind of hit, yes, I'm sure, because that would have, I could have just been, no, didn't mean to do that. But I was just screaming on the microphone, but there was no way they could do that again for safety reasons, and I lost that shot.
Sure, the war's not going to stop for you.
Exactly. So everything's great.
So apart from that moment, we're happy to recommend Red as an excellent war camera.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they took the precautions of taping up all the openings except for the vent. Sound light wasn't a problem, so I had it on automatic the whole time as far as fanning was concerned. And when I got back, I mean, the dust is very fine there. It's a big problem in Iraq and Afghanistan with electronics and whatnot, but I didn't have any of those issues. I sprayed it out with compressed air, and it's been functioning back home here. So
fantastic.
Couldn't recommend it better.
So obviously you're probably looking towards either upgrading it to an Epic or lashing out on a Scarlett as well. I'm sure either of those would be great.
Yes. The Epic, just for the extra frame rates and the size savings alone could come in very handily. But more than anything, for the entire military, not just what I'm trying to propose here, the Scarlett, I'm pretty sure, is going to revolutionize that. Simply because of its size and the immense amount of options you'll have with the quality that they'll bring at 3K, the frame rate, you know, the added exposure range coming from SD cameras or even the minor HD cameras that they're fielding out there, to be able to not just shoot in a calm version of a combat zone back at the base or going on convoys or flying on flights, but to be able to carry the Scarlett-sized camera around with you in actual combat interaction, much like the combat cameramen do with the GL1-sized or the Sony Handycam-sized cameras, will bring an actual epic new experience back, not only for possible use in historical footage, but in for reviewing engagements that could be going down. With that much resolution and the ability to shoot at those high frame rates, you could have amazing after-action reports alongside footage that can be used for any purpose.
Yeah, look, I'm sure there'll be a lot of XL1s on eBay when that thing comes out.
Yeah. And I loved the XL1. I mean, anybody that's coming up, especially high schools or any kind of training environment, you can do a lot with that camera.
Yeah.
Danny Boyle, I think, was the one that proved that with 28 Days Later.
Yeah, a real film fan.
Yeah.
That's great. You're out there shooting during the day. So what's your usual workflow with this footage?
Okay, I would have usually a late afternoon. So, and the Afghanistan mountain ranges were actually kind of great for that. You'd have a very extended magic hour, so to speak. So I could go out and film. I'd use the cards. I had 4 cards, 8 GB. I'd shoot what I wanted and take it back to the living area where I had my MacBook Pro 17-inch and latest Final Cut at the time, and I was shooting on build 14. So I would take the cards back, dump them off to a little external hard drive, and then dump the proxies into Final Cut. They would sequence would basically auto-adapt, and I could make any minutiae changes that I wanted, white point and motion rendering. And then I would edit in the 2K timeline and then render out some web tests. And along the way on Red User, I posted little clips here and there. And that's how I did them, right off the laptop like that, I think it was 480p, essentially resolution.
Right.
And the video on Vimeo actually is all off the proxies as well. The entire we got the Scratch system access at DRNA about a month after I got back, and we started playing around with the footage there, but everything had already been edited by then. And we've played with it since, but it was all done off the proxies. And even at the 1080p resolution, I was, and everybody that looks at it is kind of amazed at the quality, and that's just straight off proxies. And a lot of people don't like proxies or the idea of it, but I was just like, crap, this looks great.
Yeah, I look at the first stuff I saw, I was just looking to 720p, and you know, that's, I'm looking at it now, and it's just fantastic.
So you think, you know, that looks pretty good, and it would only look better with even more attention paid to all the details you could.
Yep, so now you're back in the States and doing a lot of work back through your production company, Glory Cubed.
Yes, we've been doing about 3 projects over the course of the year. The first thing we actually tried officially with the Red camera was a NASCAR shoot with Dale Earnhardt. They had arranged for him to drive around a track and had an Apache fly in. And that shot, we actually loaded some of that footage onto the Red Relay.
Yeah, I saw that. It's pretty wild.
It was kind of just testing it out, and it ended up looking really cool. And the production company there loved it. They used it in a couple clips that they put together. And over the course of the year, we have been trying to get the officials up there to realize the difference that is now possible at such a low cost. And my goal all along is not so much to produce any kind of finished product. As you know, as great as that is, I enjoy filming the guard or, you know, active, the reserve, whatever, in any capacity doing their actual jobs. I don't like the recruiting commercials and whatnot that are all choreographed and staged.
Just like a Michael Bay film.
Exactly. Everybody is media savvy now. They know when they're being pandered to. Why give them a fake presentation when the guys are out there doing it, home or away, you know, all the time. Let's go out there with this equipment, film it with that in mind, and catch reality that looks impressive. You know, it has the aesthetic look to it, looks like a blockbuster, but it's real.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been trying to push, and it's hard to get that accepted because it's kind of a gamble. So that's my ultimate goal, and I'm still harping on it, but there hasn't been a lot of leeway even with the presentations.
So what's next?
Well, like I said, in this last week I've had more interest via the Vimeo page than in the last 6 months, actually. The one major advance I got was the Combat Camera Association themselves. Current and former combat cameramen are having a conference in Vegas later this year, and they've asked for me to come and give a presentation there.
Fantastic.
Recap my experience, why I think it's a viable option, feasible in every way, and hopefully it just provides more thought.
Okay, look, so how can people find you?
If you link to that Vimeo page, or you can look up Glory Cubed and send an email right through our little front page for the company we put together out here in Nashville, Tennessee. It's probably the easiest. My email address is just scott@glorycubed.
Thanks, Scott, for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. I forgot to mention how big a fan the guys are out here that I work with of FXPHD.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, I'm glad I was able to contribute in some way.
Well, look, again, thanks for your time, and yeah, good luck with it all.
All right, thank you.
Well, what a jam-packed show that's been.
It is a big one.
Between shooting in war zones and, of course, stuff from IBC and Tom, who we really appreciated letting us come on set.
Man, that was fantastic. Awesome. Such a great bunch of info there. Thank you.
And, you know, it was just fun being on set watching. You noticed something I didn't notice, actually, which was that different EVF mount on the camera they had there. Not part of the anamorphic thing.
Yeah, but looked a bit homebrew, which is cool. Well, sort of
hardcore
backyard sort of brew, homebrew kind of thing.
But interestingly, it was done, as I understand it, to just really give a solid EVF so that it couldn't be moved. So much so that at one point I remember seeing Tom saying you need a pair of pliers just to adjust it. But it was because he was sick of having the EVF kind of move on a mini arm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when you're operating, particularly handheld, when you're operating, you just want to grab whatever. You know, you see, you've got a lot of guys, especially if you're operating with like a Panavision Gold, you're just grabbing the mat box. The mat boxes are so firm on that you can operate off the mat box, wow. Or you want to operate off grabbing the viewfinder, whatever you can. You want anything, everything around you to be, you know, something really solid to grab onto and not one of those little Israeli arms.
Yeah, and we didn't discuss the project that Tom was shooting on much because clearly it's still in production. But we do want to thank the director and the team for letting us on set. That was great. They even fed us, which was very kind of them. So look, one thing.
I've got one thing. Here's a little. I know how people love unboxing on this show.
Unboxings on this show.
That's for you, which unfortunately is going to cost you money because you are going to need to buy a cheese plate to go on top of your camera to mount it. That is the Ronford Baker battery mount, which Ronford Baker kindly sent us.
Well, that's very kind of them, isn't it? We like them. So can we give them a plug? Where is the website for that?
Ronfordbaker.co.uk.
It's a .co.uk. Yeah. But this is great and it's really robust, but it's only like £25.
Exactly. It's a simple little L bracket. Basically, I've touched on a previous show before. Basically, you just take your battery plate off the back of your sort of red bracket, I guess, and mount it on this thing. Basically, it puts the battery on the side of the camera. Takes the weight off the where your red drive goes, and just nestles it on the side next to what really I suppose most people these days have got the Element Technica breakout boxes. So
yeah, well that's great. That's really terrific. And
so that £24 thing is going to cost you about $300 or something in the cheese plate and top rods.
It's definitely worth it. Excellent. Hey, there's one other thing which we're going to get into next week, but I just wanted to flag it because it's really interesting. We've run out of time this week, but you've actually found some interesting lenses for us, including an 8mm lens, which I'm desperate to hear about. So maybe you could tell us about that next week, Jase?
Yep, that's a very, very simple little 8mm lens. Awesome fisheye thing. And also next week I'll have a fantastic interview with an Australian director, top flight, top 10 car guy in Australia and worldwide, Mark Toyer. So that's
Mark is a great guy, actually. Yeah, Jim and I went up to Queensland and shot with him, and I've worked with him before. He's a really generous guy as well. Like, he's very generous with his time, very...
He's been fantastic. He's given us a lot of workflow, a lot of hints and tips from his workflow side. Basically, he's come from the stills background, so he's got one of that sort of background of owning your own gear, having everything in-house, your own studio, your own cameras, your own workflow. Basically, he does it all. That's a great little interview.
But he does it all because he wants to do a great job. It's not like he's low... budget.
No, absolutely. I mean, you see his stuff, it's you know, totally award-winning. He works around the world.
Yeah.
Non-stop.
Okay, well that's all coming up next week. We really want to appreciate you guys for basically making the show such a success. It really is pretty humbling, actually, how many people have come up to us, said they listened to the show, how many DOPs have taken the time to send us emails, and how many people in the post-production community have commented on its usefulness. So we do appreciate it. If you want to follow us, apart from obviously going to the website, you're on Twitter, Jase?
Yep. I'm just Wingrove, WINGROVE, or jasonwingrove.com.
And I'm on Twitter as Mike Seymour. So until next time, thanks so much, and we'll see you then. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC.